You know, it's really amazing what you can come up with working in the world of radio. Back in the fall of 2008, I had the bright idea of creating my own podcast series. Working out of a home studio, just using off-the-shelf technology, I was able to create high-quality sound stories to share online, as well as for broadcast over the airwaves. Here are four examples of projects I created that span my career as a freelance journalist and independent media producer. This first piece is an interview with author and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams on her book, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Believe it or not, the theme music you're about to hear, I created myself using the software program GarageBand. This is the first edition of my podcast that premiered on iTunes on January 1st, 2009. Building things of beauty from the broken pieces of what were once whole is a recurring theme throughout your book. What is the role of art in the process of healing after a tragic event?
It's such a good question, and I'm going to tell you a story. When Lily Yeh created a team of what she called barefoot artists, it consisted of Alan Jacobson, a designer from Philadelphia, Megan Morris, a graduate student from New Mexico, and myself. She asked me if I would be her scribe. We landed in Rwanda. We went immediately to see USAID, which is an NGO, an arm of the State Department, the American government, to inform them of what we wanted to do, which was work with the Rugerero Genocide Survivors Village, just outside the town of Gisenyi on the border of the Congo and Rwanda, to help build a genocide memorial for the safe placement of their beloved's bones. When we went in, Lily presented the project. She showed the design, the architecture, the plan. And the head of USAID was so patronizing, I have to say. He said, "This is a very nice art project, but Rwanda needs food." And that was his statement. And I never will forget Lily looking at him and saying, "There are many ways to feed a person, and perhaps first you start with the soul." It was such a brave statement, and she was talking about how beauty is not peripheral, that art is not optional, but in fact a survival for strategy. And in Rwanda, in one of the most broken of all places that now is engaged in a period of reconstruction, art, beauty, is part of that vision that is coming from President Paul Kagame, from the ministers, and most importantly, from the people themselves.
You said that the events of 9/11/2001 took away your ability to make poetry. You were yourself apparently broken. What has the writing of this book done to help you remake yourself?
Again, that's such an astute question. It's true. You know, I was in Washington, D.C., on September 11th, I think if I had been home in the desert in Castle Valley, James, I wouldn't have even known what would have happened. We don't have a television. We barely get radio. But there, you saw how quickly the district shut down. You saw how rapidly the rhetoric of our country changed to one of fear and terror and blame, rather than introspection and reflection and compassion. In that moment, I made a decision to speak. And I think it was as a result of disorientation, you know, and manipulation. I remember hearing Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska saying, "It's not if we're going to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but when." And I heard myself saying, "There are many forms of terrorism, and environmental degradation is one of them." You know, later on, when Dick Cheney was creating our national energy policy behind closed doors in Utah, it was a ground-thumping experience, where 40,000-pound thumper trucks were roaring across wilderness study areas, Dome Plateau, 7 miles outside of Arches National Park. I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times describing that. I was writing more for newspapers and magazines than anything, just trying to create a conversation. What scared me after a year of this was that I had lost my poetry, that my words had become as brittle and hollow as those I was opposing. I was in Maine, we were on family vacation, I was desperate to retrieve that which I had lost. I went down to the waters and call it a prayer or a plea. And I said to the ocean, I'll be honest, give me one wild word and I promise I will follow. And the word that came into my heart, the word that I heard, the word that rolled back from the sea was mosaic. And I followed that. And I could never have imagined that this plea, this question of a word, would have led me to Ravenna, Italy, to see those bejeweled ceilings made out of glass, that it would have led me to my, it would have taken me home to the Colorado Plateau, the grassland plateau inhabited by prairie dogs, that I would have seen it as an ecological mosaic, broken and beautiful. I never would have imagined that it would have ultimately led me to Rwanda, creating a genocide memorial, mosaics, literally out of the rubble of war.
Over the last 8 years, you've done a lot of very interesting things, things that you just mentioned. How are these things, seemingly unrelated activities, come together to form the core of your new book?
You know, I never know what I'm doing. I don't know if you feel that way, but I just trust my instincts and the questions that lead me forward. How are they related? You know, that's really a good question. They're related to me in ways that are both inexplicable and obvious in my own patterned mind. You know, it could be argued, you know, why on earth would you have a discussion of the peril, the plight of a prairie dog and a genocide in Rwanda, the genocide in Rwanda? And for me, it's about seeing the world whole. It's recognizing that the extermination of a species, the extermination of a people, are predicated on the same impulses: prejudice, cruelty, ignorance, and arrogance, circling around issues of power and justice. And I honestly believe, James, that until we can begin to see the world whole, even wholly, we will be relegated, consigned, imprisoned in a fractured, fragmented world that ultimately becomes a seedbed of war, over and over repeating this cycle. We know that the world is interconnected. We know that it's the pattern of things that illuminate our relationship to other. And this is what I'm interested in, both as a writer and, most importantly, as a human being. The semblances of things, how we respond to one another, how we are present with one another, and how we bear witness to the miraculous nature of life, even in its brokenness.
One of my primary goals as a journalist is to create sound-rich and compelling stories for radio. In this next piece, I traveled to Chicago to produce a segment for the series My America 2008 on urban gun violence for the Public Radio International program, The Tavis Smiley Show.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley, and this is My America 2008, our special edition on gun violence in America. Producer James Mills continues now with his report on how Chicago has been grappling with a streak of violence that's claimed the lives of at least 100 people since January.
Since January of this year, 131 homicides were committed on the streets of Chicago. Most were the result of the thoughtless use of a firearm. Many of those killed were young African-American men. Poverty, poor public education, substance abuse, and other difficult life circumstances combine with the ready availability of handguns to lead these men vulnerable to sudden violent death.
My name is Cliff. I'm 23. I'm from the west side of Chicago.
People like Clifford Brown, his friends call him Herky, get shot.
I've been shot three different times, two different times in 1 week or two apart, a year later, in the head, 9 times all together.
Herky's life on the streets of Chicago makes him vulnerable to gun violence. He's unemployed and very little occupies his time. He has a limited education. He sometimes abuses alcohol. And he's been known to hang out with a rough crowd, people for whom petty crime and violence is a way of life. In his West Side Chicago neighborhood, Herky wonders if one day he might get shot again, or even killed.
I don't want to, and I pray that every day that I don't have to shoot nobody. hurt nobody or nobody hurt me.
Fortunately, a violence prevention program called Ceasefire keeps an eye on Herky to help him to stay safe and out of trouble. Director of Mediation, Teo Hardiman, said outreach caseworkers and so-called violence interrupters work with over 900 high-risk individuals throughout the Chicago area.
They are trained to go out and talk to the guys that are most prone to commit acts of violence. You know, young guys get into the most pettiest of conflicts, and violence interrupters and outreach workers walk the streets all during the night and the day so they can find out what's going on in the community. See, they have to know the pulse of the community.
Conflict resolution has been a part of the Ceasefire program since 2004. And according to program officials, from 2004 through June of 2007, decreases in violent crime in Chicago can be attributed to their efforts. But cuts in state funding 9 months ago to the tune of $6.2 million eliminated a number of caseworkers. Hardiman is convinced that the recent uptick in neighborhood gun violence can be linked to shortfalls in state support.
August, September, of last year, the shootings were down, like 159 shootings down, and the same time this year, 102 shootings up.
Today, Ceasefire caseworkers number fewer than 30. Before the cutbacks, there were more than 100. Violence prevention professionals like Hardiman hope that in failing to provide conflict resolution services, local, state, and federal governments in the U.S. will provide instead financial solutions to the social problems faced by America's cities.
The impoverished and these very, very poor communities need an economic stimulus plan similar to what they're trying to do in Iraq, but I guess the people in the United States are not really worthy of it. It appears to be that way because the leaders are not looking at it that way. They know that a lot of factories have closed down. They know that a lot of businesses are not making the money they used to make, so therefore there's a need.
That kind of political leadership might come in our next presidential administration. But violence interrupter Alfonso Prater doesn't expect much to change anytime soon.
Out of my life, it once a governor mess up for 8 years, it take 20 years to fix. They ain't gonna do it in no 4 years because all of them ain't gonna be on the same page. They fighting. Everybody fighting.
So conflict resolution programs like Ceasefire have to do what they can to keep the fighting on the street from ending in gun violence. That's a message some young men like Herky are taking to heart.
And Ceasefire, they be out talking to the guys, young guys like me, trying to keep everybody out of trouble or whatever. Stop it. Put the guns down. That's how they come. And we're going to find a way to resolve this.
According to conflict resolution professionals like Hardiman, without more cool heads and voices of reason on the streets, gun violence in Chicago and across the country is likely to continue. Reporting for My America 2008, I'm James Mills. Among my favorite public radio programs is the weekly magazine show, To the Best of Our Knowledge. Working with the production staff right here in Madison, I travel to Yosemite Valley, California to collect natural sound and conduct interviews to create a short segment on the African-American cavalrymen known as the Buffalo Soldiers. At the turn of the last century, these men played a pivotal role in the history of the national park system. This next piece was created as part of an hour that aired in the lead-up to the release of the Ken Burns documentary, The National Parks, America's Best Idea.
The history of the national parks is full of surprising details. For instance, the first parks were patrolled and protected by the American cavalry, often soldiers who'd fought in the Civil War. It's one of the stories that Ken Burns tells in his PBS series on the national parks.
The cavalry was also in charge of the nation's three other national parks, General Grant, Sequoia, and the high country surrounding Yosemite. Each spring, troops stationed at the Presidio in San Francisco would make the two-week, 250-mile ride to the Sierras and patrol the three parks during the summer season. Some of them were African Americans, the celebrated Buffalo Soldiers of the 9th and 10th Cavalry, who had made a name for themselves in the Indian Wars.
Independent producer James Mills watched the Ken Burns series with more than a little interest, not only to learn about the Buffalo Soldiers, but it also made him wonder, why do so few African Americans visit the national parks today? James has this story.
The thing about a Ken Burns documentary,
He'll blow your mind with what you don't know about your own history. I've been going to Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks since I was a kid. I even led backpacking trips into the northern Sierra Nevada mountains while I was in college. But I never knew that people who look like me, African Americans, played any role in creating the national parks. Look around. Today you hardly see any black people outdoors hiking or climbing or skiing. Sure, I'd heard of the Buffalo Soldiers, but what did they have to do with Yosemite and Sequoia? I had to get some answers. In San Francisco, there's a historic military base called the Presidio, near the Golden Gate Bridge. Here, the Buffalo Soldiers were stationed, the African-American horsemen of the 9th and 10th Cavalry Divisions.
Okay. Might be a little bit of a smell here.
Smell the horses!
Frederick Penn is an interpretive ranger for the National Park Service. He's showing me around an old U.S. cavalry stable. It's now the home of the police department's equestrian unit.
Well, the Buffalo Soldiers were recruited at the end of the Civil War. A lot of people don't realize that there were 100,000 African Americans in blue Yankee uniforms, more soldiers than the U.S. Army wanted to keep in uniform and to pay them.
You see, after the war, everyone expected the black soldiers would just go back to being farmers or working in factories in the North.
But Congress at the time, because it was in the hands of the radical Republicans, which was pretty much the party of Lincoln and therefore the party of African Americans, they decided that they should form some units of regular soldiers to volunteer.
Most of the Army's white soldiers were deployed in the occupation of the defeated South. So African-American soldiers were sent west, where they fought the Plains Wars against the Native American tribes who gave them their name.
When they first encountered the Plains Indians had really never seen en masse those many African-American soldiers. And according to the legend of how they got their name, the Native Americans felt like the curly hair they had reminded them of the curly hair between the horns of the buffalo and the black faces. And also how tenaciously the Buffalo Soldiers fought them. They fought with the spirit of the buffalo.
The Buffalo Soldiers would go on to fight in the Spanish-American War in Cuba, alongside Teddy Roosevelt and his band of Rough Riders. They were deployed to quell the insurrection in the Philippines. And here's where it gets good. At the turn of the 20th century, they were sent to protect and preserve the newly designated national parks of Yellowstone and Sequoia. And more than 400 Buffalo Soldiers made the 14-day journey on horseback from San Francisco to Yosemite, where they actively patrolled the park to keep it safe.
One summer, I think summer of 1903, they were led by one of the only African-American officers at the time, Captain Charles Young, who was the third black graduate of West Point. And Captain Young, because he was in charge of the 9th Cavalry troops that were there, he ostensibly became the superintendent of Sequoia Kings Canyon. So this was the first time in history that a African American was superintendent of a national park.
Under the command of Charles Young, the Buffalo Soldiers did more for park preservation than all previous cavalry units combined. Their work in Yosemite and Sequoia helped shape some of our first national parks. Yosemite is still one of the most beautiful places on Earth. Each year, millions of people come to see its high granite cliffs, spectacular waterfalls, and lush green meadows. But very few African Americans visit the very park the Buffalo Soldiers helped to create. The same goes for other wild places around the country. How ironic is that?
It's doubly ironic to think that 100 years ago, there were more Africans or people of African descent in an official capacity in both Yosemite National Park and Sequoia National Park than there are today.
Shelton Johnson is an authority on the history of the Buffalo Soldiers. He's also the only permanent African-American park ranger in Yosemite.
You know, Charles Young was the first African-American superintendent of Sequoia National Park during the military period in 1903, and that's not been repeated. There has not yet been another African-American superintendent of Sequoia National Park.
And the story of the Buffalo Soldiers is all the more remarkable when you consider the time they lived.
Think about how much the world has changed. They were here before there was a Malcolm X, before there was Martin Luther King, before Shirley Chisholm, before all of these people that we know so well. They were here when Jim Crow was Jim Crow. I mean, actually, before, to some degree. They were here at a time when race relations were at their most abysmal.
The great irony is that relatively few African Americans have gone to our national parks since they were created. Nina Roberts, a professor in the Department of Recreation at San Francisco State University, says many parks actually reinforced practices of legal discrimination.
People will say, well, there are no signs in front of the parks that prohibit you from going. Now, today we know that to be true. However, the reality is, in the 1950s, there were signs that limited where people could go if they could go at all. Picnic area for blacks only. Actually, back in the day, they said Negroes only. Picnic area for whites. The segregation still occurred in parks.
Add to that the history of violence by white supremacists, and African Americans tended to stay home. Living memory persists, and today, most blacks avoid national parks and other wild settings. Take the story of Ranger Bill Gwaltney, an assistant to the Western Regional Director of the National Park Service based in Denver. His job is to recruit and train a more diverse park workforce and to encourage people of color to visit the parks.
My father grew up in Southern Virginia near the North Carolina border in the 1920s and 30s. And when I announced to him my interest in becoming a national park ranger, he immediately had to counter with a story. And the story was that as a kid growing up in South Virginia in an African-American enclave, he had five friends or acquaintances who went missing, who either were found, lynched, or never found at all. They were close to the Great Dismal Swamp. And he said to me, boy, there are a lot of trees in those woods, and rope is cheap. His first concern was not for whether I was going to be financially taken care of or whether people would treat me okay in the work setting or whether I was going to be halfway across the country. His first concern was for my physical safety.
Professor Roberts says these ideas persist even today.
Even though people would say, I didn't live during that time, I don't know what that was like, they learn from their elders, they learn from their grandparents, or they've read the stories and they know and are connected to their history and their heritage. That is huge for us to understand.
Take a look at our history. Slavery, post-Civil War racial violence, Jim Crow discrimination, segregation.
People say, get over it, get over it. How do you get over what's in your blood? How do you get over the experiences of your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and your great-great-grandparents, the stories that you were told as a child? I mean, racism obviously still exists today, and its roots are in that period, that history, that legacy of slavery.
Ranger Shelton Johnson believes that African Americans' apparent aversion to nature is a direct consequence of our past.
We went from a people who were so bound to the earth in a good way to being bound to the earth in a bad way. We became the most urbanized and urban and urbane group of Africans on the face of the earth. But there's a cost to that. And that cost is that loss of that which was Africa. And so my feeling is that Africa is part of the earth, and so is America. And so find Africa where you are. Find Africa in the world that's outside you. And so for me, I found Africa in Yellowstone. I found Africa in Yosemite. I found Africa in Great Basin, because what I found was the earth itself. And when you're connected to the earth and feel that raw, natural environment around you, you close your eyes and the ancestors start to sing.
And on this earth resides the enduring spirit of the Buffalo Soldiers, who despite the circumstances of their time, stood to fight and defend not only our sacred American land, but the very idea of liberty and justice for all.
And so when I see myself wearing this uniform, I'm also making a challenge that people of my culture can also be part of this history. And no, we are part of this history. And that is the value of the Buffalo Soldier story, is that it's dating that at the very beginning of this great invention and this great contribution to world culture, which of course is America's best idea, that we were part of it from the very beginning.
One of the things that I really enjoy about my work as a producer is the ability to tell some amazing stories. But, you know, they're not my stories. They're the stories of incredibly interesting people, and through my work, I have the ability to bring these stories to life. In this next piece, I speak to best-selling author Cheryl Strayed about her book, Wild, and her experiences hiking the Pacific Crest Trail shortly after the death of her mother.
I was really in a place of total despair. It's strange for me to really remember it now because, you know, I'm 44 and I'm happy. I have this really rich, happy life. But at that time, I really felt like I didn't feel that I could go on. I mean, I had worked myself into such a place of sorrow, you know, over the grief of my mother. But then the things I did in that grief brought me further down. You know, I made bad decisions. I was, you know, sexually promiscuous. I cheated on my husband who I loved. And that was, you know, really against my values. It was against the person I am. I'm not against promiscuity. I think it can have its moment, but you know, in a life. But it was not the good thing for me to be doing in that context. I was deceiving someone I loved. I was deceiving, really sort of violating, you know, a promise I'd made to someone I cared about. And then I got involved with drugs. And anyone who's ever, you know, been under the influence knows that those things we reach for them because we think they'll make us feel better, and they always make us feel worse. You know, when you reach for them in desperation, they make you feel worse. And so those things were all affecting my state of mind too. And I got to the point where I thought, well, why should I? You know, why should I go on living? Who would care if I disappeared? And I was feeling so much pain that it was the first time I understood how it is that people would choose to end their lives. I was honestly considering suicide, but I felt that kind of pain. Why go on?
Is it fair to suggest that you might have gone into the wild in an active, you know, not necessarily of self-destruction, but at that moment in time, perhaps to become reborn in a way?
Yes. I mean, I think what I've been doing is, you know, throwing myself up against risk. I was doing dangerous things. I mean, I was shooting heroin. I was having sex with people I hardly knew, not always protected. I felt like I could take risks because I felt like, okay, nobody cares about me, so I don't have to care about myself, you know? And I was also coming to terms with, you know, back there's also my father, who was an abusive father, not a person in my life. I think when my mom died, the stuff with my father that I thought I had sort of resolved, which really I'd just resolved by burying, really emerged. And I felt that kind of sorrow too. So, you know, I think when I made the decision to go into the wild, it was like I needed to test myself, my strength against something, but it was like a positive risk. It was like, okay, I'm going to go be daring in a way that actually builds my soul rather than depletes it. Hmm.
I get the impression from your book that you did heroin for the first time on impulse. It was, I would describe it as a very impulsive act.
Yeah.
And you also just a moment ago described heroin as the opposite of hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. Is it fair to suggest that hiking the PCT was also a compulsive act?
I think the decision seems compulsive, you know, because it was like I'm standing in a line, I grab this book off the shelf, and I think, I'm going to do that. On the other hand, some of my best decisions have come in like that. And I think it didn't rise out of nothing. You know, just like my decision to use heroin, the woman who was offered heroin and said yes was a woman who was suffering, who was alone, who was in a state of despair, and willing to basically try anything. So that rose out of that moment. The woman who decided to hike the PCT was someone who was realizing that, you know, she'd gone way too far down an alley that she never intended to go. And I didn't know how to find my way back. But when I read about the PCT, I thought, it's going to get me somewhere. Walking that trail will lead me somewhere, and it will probably be somewhere good.
You know, I aspire to do nothing more than to create stories like this and others into the future. Audio production is one of my greatest pleasures in life, and thank you so much for considering my work. And special thanks to Jake Chimo Bakuro for allowing me to use his music. I'm James Mills.